My name's Anna Dubuisse Ray. I'm a senior UK lawyer, and I've been working with a whole team of lawyers, both UK and internationally, for probably over a year now to drill down into the, you know, evidence and the legal analysis. But we're also working with the HART group, you know, the Health Advisory Research Team, COVID-19 Assembly, the World Doctors Alliance, UK Freedom Alliance, and us for them, various campaign groups, and basically, you know, working together for the last year to try and understand what's going on, to bring legal action, to analyse the evidence, to, you know, work out which witnesses we really should be relying on. And that's all in the context that I'm a retired army officer as well. So one of the first things that brought me into all of this was the fact that when this virus was released, I was pretty convinced straight away that it was a bioweapon, because, you know, I've had nuclear, biological, chemical warfare training, and it was just immediately hackles up. This isn't right.
What was it about this that made you think that?
Well, to be fair, I was already on pretty high alert for bioweapons being released, because obviously I'm aware that, you know, bioweapons have been created for a very long time. And I was aware of the Wuhan lab being set up. It was my instinct initially that it didn't feel right. And then when I started scrutinizing the story about, you know, it being from bats or pangolins, I thought, no, that doesn't sound right either. And so I contacted an ex-army friend of mine who was on the ground in Beijing in the first lockdown. And we spent about 2.5 hours on the phone going through the evidence and, you know, what was going on, and comparing notes about what he was being told over in Beijing compared to what we were being told over in the UK. And I was able to ask him, for example, you know, we're seeing pictures of people falling dead on the streets, and he said it's all nonsense. And, you know, because he's lived in China for a while, you know, he's very aware of the programming, et cetera, that goes on and the false stories. And so he was able to, you know, fill in a few dots for me. And it went from there, really, just reaching out into my veteran network and finding out what they thought about it, whether it was a bioweapon or not. I heard Francis Boyle. Have you come across Francis Boyle, the bioweapons expert in America? He was speaking out very early on. And he actually drafted the biowarfare legislation that was passed by both houses of the Senate. And he's actually been working against biowarfare, essentially, for about 30 or 40 years. So he was coming out very early saying this is a bioweapon, this is biowarfare.
Well, how can it be? Because this form of warfare is banned.
Well, exactly. But we now know, of course, that there was a moratorium placed on this trimeric gain-of-function research in America. And, you know, Francis Boyle was absolutely instrumental in drafting that. And the reason he drafted it, because I've interviewed him, the reason he drafted it was because he was always afraid that this kind of incident would occur. And that was precisely why they placed a moratorium on it. Because on his evidence, there is no health benefit to conducting trimeric gain-of-function research. You know, they've taken viruses, spliced them together, and made them, you know, more lethal, more infectious, and increased fatality rate. Well, there's no, you know, benefit to that to society. So he was very, very clear that it's biowarfare. And then, of course, there were others like Dr. Lee Merritt, who's she was a retired army officer as well, surgeon, and she was saying it was a bioweapon, and then various, you know, more and more experts coming out. And of course, from their point of view, they can actually explain how it was made, whereas, you know, me being a lawyer, I needed to be educated about that. But it became irrefutable. You know, we took enough witness evidence and looked at enough of the evidence, and as you know, with lawyers, it has to become beyond reasonable doubt if you're going to allege criminal activity. And it got to a point where, you know, unfortunately, we reached the conclusion that it was beyond reasonable doubt, which is why I've now gone public and said, you know, on our analysis, and this was back in March, April, our analysis was that we needed to make an application, urgent application to the International Criminal Court. And we, you know, looked at the definitions of genocide, of crimes against humanity and biowarfare with what was going on in the evidence and the experts we heard. And it was irrefutable. So eventually, you know, I've had to come out and speak out, I'm afraid.
What about the police, though? Because some, I know that, you know, you've had these encounters with the police where the police are simply saying to you, I'm sorry, that the vaccinations that are taking place here are perfectly legal and perfectly safe.
Well, actually, what he said was, you know, the well, I know, you know, the vaccine is legal and it might be your opinion. And he was going to carry on. And I said, no, they're not legal. And he said, yes, they are, they're legal. And I said, no, they're not legal, they're not lawful, they're not ethical and moral. And what was interesting when you analyse his response was that all he kept coming back with, talking over me the entire time, was the vaccine's legal, vaccine's legal, vaccine's legal. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That puts a red flag up because he hasn't dealt with the lawful, the moral and the ethical. He's just focusing on the legal.
Yes, but the thing is, Anna, they've been approved by the regulators, have approved these for public use, so they are legal.
Well, okay, it's our analysis that this is not a human medicine. These, you know, specifically the mRNA injections, they cannot be legally defined either as a vaccine or as a human medicine, which is how they've been regulated under the human medicines regulations. Because, in fact, according to our expert teams, both here and abroad, this is, you know, mRNA's synthetic piece of code, which is a piece of nanotechnology encased in a lipid nanoparticle encasing. And that fits the definition of a medical device rather than a human medicine. And as such, it should be regulated under the medical devices regulations, which is why I'm saying it's not legal, because it's not being authorized under and regulated under the correct framework. But also under the Public Health Control of Diseases Act 1984, Section 45E specifically says you cannot mandate, you know, prophylactic treatment, etc. So, you know, the question of legality goes across several areas of law. It's not just whether it's been regulated properly under that particular bit of legislation. And my view is that's why they're so desperate to say, yes, it's legal, yes, it's legal, because actually they know that they've spun on a pinhead to try and get an emergency temporary authorization, which is all they've got. And they've only got an emergency temporary authorization on the basis that, A, there's an emergency. Well, there is no emergency because we've got alternative treatments and, you know, we know the figures have been manipulated, etc. And as for, you know, the basis on which to justify it, it has to be on the basis that there is no alternative treatments. Well, there are. So, you know, their whole legality comes massively into question, which is why I was very firm saying it's not legal. But, you know, a lot of these arguments will need to go in front of the court or the public. And you know, one of the reasons I'm speaking out is because it's our analysis that it's going to take too long to try and bring any case in front of the judges. We're then not certain which judges are actually awake, because our intelligence says that an awful lot of them have bought the narrative, they're double jabbed, masked up, and just following the narrative. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is where the court for public opinion comes in. You know, we need to put our legal analysis out there and our evidence and invite the public to look at it and debate it.
It sounds to me as if you're saying this is absolutely an enormous error or enormous mistake or even an enormous criminal act. What's going on?
Well, my own view about the way they've licensed it is that I do think they've danced on a pinhead. That's my favourite expression, because whether it's criminal or not will, you know, only time will tell in terms of how a tribunal or a judge or the public will determine this. But in terms of deciding whether something's criminal, obviously we have to look at the definition of these crimes and the definition of criminal acts generally, what makes something criminal as opposed to civil. And, you know, I don't know how much you know and how much the listeners would know, but basically with criminal law, you have to commit the act that's led to the harm, suffering, loss or death. And you have to have committed the act with intent to do harm. But the thing about intent is that it can be, you know, you can infer the intent because it's based on knowledge. So if you know that the act you've committed is going to cause harm, loss, suffering or death, then that's your intent to do it. And knowledge can be imputed. So the thing that we're trying to establish is how much of this is criminally intentional, how much of it is negligent, misfeasance, misconduct. And the analysis is that it crosses many, many different areas of both statute law, civil law, criminal law, common law, God's laws, international law. So frankly, the legal analysis is vast because there are so many different laws being broken. I mean, it's absolutely horrendous. We lawyers are totally gobsmacked at just how all the laws seem to be being trashed. Nobody seems to care to uphold them. And it's, you know, it's a crisis. Frankly.
What about actually going through the courts though? So surely that's your ultimate aim, is to put this. You say it's going to take a long time, but there must be some kind of legal action. I noticed that, for example, I was hearing last week that in some places that the rollout of these so-called vaccines to children has been stopped. And this is after chief constables have been mailed with evidence that the children could be harmed by these. So It does seem that the police may be beginning to act. But, I mean, you obviously need to get something, you know, if there is a crime being committed here, people should be arrested and prosecuted.
Well, absolutely. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons that we called the police in when we attended the vaccine clinic to, you know, assist us with serving these people, because the first step in this process for us is to serve notices of liability on those that we identify as breaking the laws. As to whether it's criminal, you know, as I say, our evidence is beyond reasonable doubt, but we then have to invite the police to investigate. And our intel is that the police have got a protocol in place saying don't accept any complaints of this nature from the public. I don't know if that's true. I can't verify it, but that's what I've been told from multiple sources. And indeed, it's been our experience because, as you know, there was Mark Sexton who's produced his crime report, 2 bundles of documents, about 1,200 pages of evidence, which as a retired police officer, he knows the evidence that they need to be looking at. And he's had trouble getting them to investigate it, accept his evidence and actually promise that they will do something about it. And I think he put that in April and we're now in July. I don't know whether you know about the mass criminal complaint that was put in by various people from the UK Freedom Alliance, various others, and 30,000 people submitted individual criminal complaints, only to be told that because most of it was being levied against the MPs, that, you know, it wasn't for the police to investigate. They had to take it up with their MPs, and yet the complaint was about the MPs as part of it. So, you know, frankly, we can only take it to the police and for them to investigate if they accept and investigate these claims. And this is, you know, again, one of the reasons we're in such crisis, because, you know, the police, instead of being our public servants who are obliged, if a member of the public comes in with prima facie evidence, they are required to investigate it. And ultimately, it's not for them to decide. They have to pass it on to the, you know, the Director of Public Prosecutions and the legal team, and they will decide. But at the moment, what we've got are police, you know, policemen and women saying, nope, not even going to look at this, not even. I was at that vaccine clinic. I brought about 10 lever arch files full of evidence. And I had set out in a 47-page notice of liability our main allegations. And I invited the police to at least look at the notice or at least flick through the bundles of evidence. And they just were not interested. Didn't even want to look at it. You know, that's bearing in mind, it was me as a senior lawyer and another senior lawyer there. So two lawyers are saying to the police, you know, this is prima facie evidence of crimes beyond reasonable doubt. And they're saying, no, I'm not interested.
Was there anything that particularly tipped you over the edge towards thinking this is beyond reasonable doubt now? Any specific bits of evidence that made you think that?
Oh, specific bits of evidence. As to which crime are we talking about? Because we're talking about multiple ones.
Well, I suppose, the obvious one is this idea of administering a so-called medical treatment, which is actually going to harm people rather than heal them.
Yeah, well, exactly that, which is why I went down to the clinic, because what we've established in our local community is that there was, you know, there was sufficient evidence to know that various clinics in the area were not obtaining informed consent from people. And that people were, in fact, dying and being seriously harmed by it. So what we've done is set out in this notice the fact that, you know, ultimately, you know, if you are injecting another person with a substance, it is entirely upon you as the individual, because it is personal, civil and criminal liability that you're facing. It's entirely on you as the individual to make sure that you have obtained fully informed consent freely given. And the problem is with the evidence that's coming out all over the place is that an awful lot of the injectors, the vaccinators, are not obtaining informed consent. So, for example, we are working with a senior NHS whistleblower. He's a surgeon. So obviously he has to deal with informed consent all the time. But he trains people in informed consent as well. And I asked him to check the protocols that were being given to the vaccinators as to how they were going to be injecting people. And he examined them and he said there is nothing in there about the law or informed consent. It's all about how to administer the injection. And what's also come out is that, you know, nurses and doctors are not routinely taught about the law. They're not routinely talked about Nuremberg and what happened there. And it appears that, you know, the whole informed consent thing is just being pretty roundly ignored. So more evidence, lots of reports coming out that people aren't even given the patient information leaflet, which actually contains a lot of warnings about the side effects and what you need to do to ensure that you have a clinical individual risk assessment prior to going along for your injection, because the patient information leaflets specifically say, for example, the Pfizer one, that you should get an allergy test for all of the ingredients, including the active one. Well, you can't be informed of that if you're given the patient leaflet after you've already had the injection, which is what is happening all over the place.
And well, there's also some very basic stuff, like, for example, people need to be asked, have you had ever before adverse reactions to a vaccine? I mean, people are simply not being asked these things.
Exactly that. Well, a lot of the clinics don't even have a clinician on hand to run people through the, you know, the individual risk assessment. But also, you know, I conducted an exercise over the last couple of weeks where I've gone on social media and I've interviewed lots of people face to face and I've said, have you read the patient information leaflet? Most of them have said, well, I didn't even know where to find it, haven't seen it, you know, don't know. When I pointed them to it, I said, have you read the list of ingredients and what it says, i.e. you should get an allergy test for this and make sure that they won't harm you. But when you look at the list of ingredients, they're indecipherable for the average person. You know, the first four ingredients listed on the Pfizer product, you know, when I put it out on Twitter, please can someone tell me what 4-hydroxy whatever it is and what BN162B is. And the most that people could come up with was to point me to chemical websites which explain the chemical compound, the molecular structure, the weight, etc., but nothing to do with how that might affect the individual's body. And also, these are, you know, even if you understand what each of the ingredients is standing on their own and what they might do to your body, these are given to you in combination. So how do we know what the combination of drugs is going to do to you? And what's even worse is that they're mixing doses. So you might start off with one set of ingredients with the AstraZeneca and then finish up, you know, however many weeks later, because they're not even giving the doses at the correct time apart, with another concoction. And how do we know that those two concoctions are going to be okay? Because the clinical trials weren't run on the basis that they would be mixing and matching dosages from different injections. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
But Anna, you're up against one of the most powerful, you know, well-heeled lobbies in the world, and they are looking at, you know, in a few years' time, they want to have a £200 billion annual industry injecting people with COVID vaccines. That's surely what is the end game. And so, you know, you're up against some of the riches, and you are likely to come up against, if you carry on like this, with some of the most highest paid barristers in the world.
Yeah, the thing is, though, the way I look at this is I'm telling people that they need to comply with the law. So that's absolutely fair enough. I worked at Pfizer. I was a management consultant there for 2 years. And, you know, so they know me. And the fact is that I'm only asking everybody to comply with the law. So I'm not saying that these products in themselves shouldn't be given to people, you know, bearing in mind that we are saying, however, that, you know, on the evidence, it's biowarfare that's being conducted. We're not specifically saying necessarily that each of these injections constitute biowarfare. We're using biowarfare in the greater sense because there's lots of different elements to it. But putting that aside, even if this was a fully approved, licensed medicine that had been used for years, the healthcare professional who is injecting someone has to take that person through the informed consent process. You know, and they have to advise them of the material risks and they have to comply with the law. So if any, you know, if Pfizer come and say, you know, what you're saying is outrageous, I would be saying to them, well, actually, it's not, because in your patient information leaflet, as far as I'm concerned, you have stipulated to people that they need to be aware of these side effects and these reactions. So in many ways, you, Pfizer, have done your job. I have issues with certain things they've said on their patient information leaflet, but basically they have responsibly said you need to get allergy tests. The issue I have with them, and I think this would be fair enough, and I don't see how they can criticize me for this, is to say, well, you've put the onus on the individual to find out what these ingredients are and what they're going to do to their body. But how does the individual do that? And then in the information leaflet, it says, well, if you have any questions, ask your healthcare professional. But it's the same. How does the healthcare professional look at that list of ingredients and say, yeah, I know what each of those are. I know what they're going to do in combination. They can't. And so my question back to the manufacturers is, why aren't you explaining in your patient information leaflet what each of these ingredients are and what they might do to your body? Now, I'm not an expert in their field of writing these, so I don't know whether they consider that's way beyond their remit. But if it is way beyond their remit in their eyes, then everyone's falling between two stools, because the healthcare professionals can't answer all the questions. Most of the public can't answer the questions, so they can't ask each other. And the manufacturer's not telling them. So how does anybody find out?
Well, look, back in 2003, we went to war with Iraq. It turned out that was an illegal war. Surely what we're dealing with here is just a bunch of leaders, you know, our so-called leaders, who don't really care that much about whether what they're doing is legal or not. They just get on and do what they want to do.
Well, I, you know, the analysis that we've all undergone, us lawyers, you know, saying, my goodness, what on earth is going on here? Is the fact that, of course, the vast majority of people making decisions are not lawyers. I have no idea what legal advice they're taking, if they're taking any at all, or if they're taking it and just ignoring it. I don't know, obviously. But what I do know is you're absolutely right that they just seem to be totally disregarding the law, unless it suits them, in which case they're dancing on a pinhead to make existing laws suit their narrative. But yeah. It's absolutely shocking, frankly. And but when you think about the MPs in Parliament, how many of them are lawyers? How many of them know the law? How many of them are checking before they, you know, break the law?
Well, they quite a few are supposedly lawyers, but often, you know, we think we're probably dealing with some sort of groupthink here, where everyone is, you know, sort of pinning all their hopes on vaccines as the only solution, and yet that could be a flawed solution.
Yep, well, totally. You've heard the evidence of Geert Van den Bosch, one of the world's experts, who says it's an absolute disaster to give, you know, prophylactic so-called vaccines in the middle of a pandemic. And his evidence is backed up by lots of world experts that this is a disastrous strategy. That's not my expertise, but, you know, I'm just feeding back to you what the experts have said to us.
Okay, well, what's the best way for people to, if they're interested in these legal challenges, whereabouts should they go to check them out?
Okay, well, what I've established last week, we've set up a website called the Informed Consent Alliance. And what we're inviting people to do, I've got a Telegram channel as well, I can send you the link, the Informed Consent Campaign. And what we're doing is we're encouraging people to start campaigning on different levels. So the first thing to do is to ask people to contact the manufacturers and ask them to explain what's in the product. What are these ingredients? How do we get allergy tests? And record the conversations, because various people have tried, including myself. I phoned Pfizer 3 times and I couldn't get past the receptionist. So I'm asking people to phone up and challenge the manufacturer and say, explain it to us, please. You know, this is not okay that we're all left to our own devices trying to work out what's in your product. And the second thing to do is to actually go to the local clinic and find out from them what informed consent protocols they are taking people through. Because, as I say, on our evidence, they are routinely not. And it may well be that you go down to a vaccine clinic and you ask them to show them their informed consent protocols and check that they've got, you know, the material risks, you know, to tell people. And if they are complying, then fantastic. You know, we've just found a best practice example. But if they're not complying, then they need to be served with notices of liability. Because these people, if they are not taking people through informed consent and people are suffering serious harm and death, that is a criminal liability they face. You've presumably heard all the criticism that's been levied at Kate Shemarani about her speech in Trafalgar Square, where she discussed Nuremberg. Well, actually, what Kate says is that during the Nuremberg trials, doctors and nurses were, you know, held liable for their actions, and some of them were hanged. And of course, the Chinese whispers now is that Kate is calling for hanging, which is not. She's simply stating the fact of what happened. And I think it's very important for the public to understand that. It's not that she's issuing death threats, which is how it's being presented. She is simply citing the International Military Tribunal's judgment of the doctors and nurses in the 1940s when they were brought to trial. And under the death penalty, under the sentencing regime, you know, if it was considered that these people were beyond reasonable doubt and irrefutable and they had caused mass murder, they were given the death penalty, and the death penalty was by hanging. So, you know, that's just statements of fact that she's made. And people have contacted me and threatened me and said, you know, you're threatening all of us nurses. And I said, no, I'm not threatening you. I'm telling you what the law says. I'm telling you what happened when this all happened before, and I'm telling you what the consequences were. If you find that threatening, that's the law that's threatening you. You know, those are the previous International Military Tribunal judgments that are threatening you. It's the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court that's threatening you. It's not people telling you that this will be the consequences of your actions if you don't, you know, comply with the law.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Why do you think the media is twisting things in that way?
I think there's a huge amount of ignorance about Nuremberg. A lot of people haven't even heard of the Nuremberg trials, let alone bothered to read the judgments. And actually, I have read the judgments, and it's incredibly important reading, because when you read them, essentially everything that's happening now is cited in the Nuremberg trials. You know, doctors and nurses saying, oh, I had to keep my job. Oh, I had to keep quiet. Oh, there was a culture of blame and silence. Oh, I had a mortgage. I had relatives to look after. All the same reasons that people are giving today. And yet, when you hear how those defences were put forward and then how the tribunal dealt with them, you will see very clearly that there is, first of all, ignorance of the law is no defence. So the fact that people say, well, I didn't know I was breaking the law is no defence. The fact that they've put their job, their you know, reputation, their humility or whatever in front of not killing people is not a defence. You know, it's not okay to say, well, I kept my job, but I just turned a blind eye to what happened. And I think, you know, if people understood that, they wouldn't be reacting the way they were, because it is a legal process of bringing people to account. But they have, you know, the ignorance of not having looked at those tribunal judgments and understanding them, and just assuming that, you know, it's a bunch of crazy conspiracy nutters asking everyone to be hanged, is ignorance. It really is. Because if you've read those cases and you understand them, you wouldn't be saying it. You really wouldn't. You would be saying, well, it's fair enough in society if someone injects someone and they haven't warned them that they might die or they might become seriously harmed and they haven't taken them through a clinical risk assessment. And so essentially they've just taken a vial full of whatever substance and injected it into someone else and walked the other way. You know, does society honestly say, yes, that's okay, we won't hold them to account?
Well, it's surely, I mean, it's a bit inflammatory to compare what's going on with the attempts to, you know, rid the country of COVID to Dr. Mengele and his experiments on concentration camp victims.
Well, it's not really, because when you look at what they did in the concentration camps, there were all kinds of things that happened, but including injection campaigns. So, for example, they claimed that there was a typhoid outbreak, and they had to experiment on the camp inmates with a typhoid vaccine to save the soldiers and to save the civilian population. So they were still injecting people with an experimental substance, calling it a vaccine, and people died. So that is cited in the judgment, that it included vaccination programs. So, you know, is it so different? Because at the end of the day, regardless of who's done it and in what time period and under what regime, the act of injecting another person with a substance without obtaining their fully informed consent freely given is a breach of criminal law. So it's the same principle being applied, whether it's Mengele or whether it's, you know, someone in the local vaccine clinic this year or someone in a vaccine clinic 20 years' time. The Ministry of Health from Israel has just produced their statistics, and they are horrifying, and they confirm exactly that, that the vast majority of people who are ending up with COVID and in hospital are vaccinated.
Okay, Anna de Bruceret, thanks very much for joining us.